Prepare for information download. RPG X-Ray is coming online in 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to RPG X-Ray, the podcast that looks inside what makes RPGs tick. If you're a gamer that wants to think about the hidden systems inside the games we love to play, join us for a regular discussion of the theory and practice of tabletop roleplaying. In our inaugural episode 1, we talk about the most critical factor at the RPG table. Fun. What is it? How do we bring the most fun to every game we play? What is the relationship between fun and difficulty? Do different players experience fun differently? All this and more coming up on RPG X-Ray. All right, this is our first episode of RPG X-Ray, and as such, we wanted to do a little bit of an introduction. I'm sitting here with Jason and Eric, and we're going to, in a moment, introduce ourselves. But first of all, what is this podcast? Why are we doing it? In short, and I'm going to ask you folks for your opinion on this, but in summary, we really want to discuss kind of deep, nerdy theories about the nature of tabletop role-playing so that other role-playing nerds like us can better understand what great play is and how to develop it at the table.
I think that's great. Thanks. So I definitely come to this feeling like I wanted to understand my craft better and understand what does my craft have to do with creating great play at the table. And I felt like there was a lot of wonderful GM advice out there. And then there was also some places like the Forge where people were really just going into kind of game studies. But somewhere in between felt like there was something missing that has really just helped me understand role playing in order for me to be able to craft great play at the table.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's kind of where I'm coming from too. It's about table play. It's about what happens at the table. And while I think we'll talk a lot about prep and, you know, the things that happen before you get to the table, the goal of it is really practical kind of discussion that you could make use of right away at the table with your players.
Yeah, we were talking a little bit earlier about, you know, what is it we want to get out of this, and I think we came up with the phrase that we're not architects or engineers, we're carpenters.
Yep.
Yeah. Right. Like we're not designing big structures. We're not designing games. Mm-hmm. We may look at how things are designed.
Yep.
But we're really looking at sort of like that practical carpentry level of role playing, which is like, well, how do you really build the chair?
Yep. Yeah, and I think that's true even from like a theory perspective. Like I think that, you know, while we may dip into kind of game theory here and there, it's always going to become from a practical lens. And right. That's really the goal.
Yeah, I have a couple books on carpentry around here somewhere, which include things like, you know, how does wood grow?
Right.
You know,
totally.
Like at some point you kind of want to know like, well, oh, how does wood expand with humidity? And role-playing games are like that. You know, at some point, we've all been playing for years, which we'll talk about here in a second. Yep. But you get to the point where you really want to understand, well, wait, what are the moving parts inside this thing that we do? Yep. It's kind of crazy that it's just sort of received wisdom,
yeah,
too, isn't
that's
it?
That's right. That's right.
Well, and I think we'll talk about this a little more, just that it is such a young craft, right? That I'm not surprised that there isn't a body of knowledge like this yet.
Before we get started, I think we should probably introduce ourselves a little bit and talk about our own background in role-playing briefly. Jason, do you want to start that one?
Yeah, I'm happy to. So my name is Jason Beaumont. I work during the day at Xbox, which means I get to spend a lot of time thinking about games and playing games and being in a community that's talking about how games are made and built. For me, for role-playing games, I really entered the hobby during kind of this wonderful period of the mid 80s where, you know, the D&D box set was out, the basic sets were out. The first RPG I got was one that my mother picked up from Walden Books, which was the old Marvel superheroes.
Nice.
That was a classic, right? And then from there, we got really into Shadowrun for a while when that first came out. That was big with me and my friends. But then a long dormant period, didn't really play much in the 90s or anything until 5th edition came out. And now I probably own more RPG books than, you know, I ever imagined owning in my entire life. So from all sorts of systems.
Jason, would you say that when you were playing when you were younger, were you principally a player, a GM, or like a mix?
I've rarely ever played. Like I don't think I actually played until I met you two. Yeah. And when you ran games, I got to experience what it was actually like as a player. And it was a wildly different experience than I thought it was as a DM for years. Yeah.
That's great. So
now I'm kind of curious. Now what do you hear more about?
It was terrible.
No, it was great. It was definitely really good. But it was also one of those things where I realized how relaxing and enjoyable it was to be a player. And I think we'll get into this later in the episode. But there's a very different kind of fun that players have than what game masters have.
Yeah. The difference between like riding the roller coaster and being the sweaty, nervous guy on the ground who's watching, making sure that it goes over that gap in the rails.
It's a great analogy. Yeah.
Yeah. I think it's almost enough different that I would say that maybe they're really two different games.
Yeah. That's a great way to put it.
So, hi everybody. I'm Eric Saltwell, and I also grew up in the tech industry. I've mostly worked on programming languages and virtual and augmented reality. I was a high school D&D nerd for my whole career. I had like a small group of three friends, and I was their perpetual GM, and we played two campaigns in 8 years. I left it, much to my wife's relief, and never thought I would come back until 5e came out. And Jason, I started playing in your group.
Yeah, and when I met your wife, she was really angry at me for reintroducing you to role-playing games. Yes.
Don't think that's any better.
Yeah.
I think since then, though, I've really had a focus on not just playing 5e, although there's a lot of people who really that's what they want to play, but I really want to play as much as I can get my hands on. Again, just so that I can get better at any of the games that I play.
Yeah, the more systems you play, you really learn kind of different lenses, different ways of playing, different approaches. Yep. And I'm totally with you.
Yep. You know, you talked about the GM and how those are really different games and how being a player was a different experience. And one thing I hope we talk about in this podcast a lot is that great play isn't just something that GMs create. But that, you know, great play is something that players need to focus on crafting as well. And I hope we talk a lot about that.
Yeah, I mean, I'll give a quick example from a recent session we had. You know, we're all playing a Call of Cthulhu campaign together. And there was this moment where, you were all going to this big gala ball in England. And as a DM, I sat down to start prepping the non-player characters for that part of the session. And because I'd read a multitude of different systems, like you mentioned earlier, I was like, you know, there's a different approach here. What I could do is just have the players create some randomization tables themselves at the table. And so one of you created a table of appearances, another created a table of backgrounds, and then we rolled almost like OSR style and generated the NPCs at the table. And the players were by far more authors of that part of the experience than I was.
All right. I'm Ethan Schoonover, and I have probably the messiest career among the three of us. I don't know. It's a bit of a mix of three common threads throughout my life, which have been technology, design, and education. I'm a longtime role-playing game player and GM. And, I started off in rural Wisconsin in the early 80s playing Pink Box, Moldvay, D&D, and that really... You know, still to this day, probably sort of one of the peak experiences is opening that box on, you know, Christmas morning and just, you know, my eyes growing wide. I think about that a lot. I think about sort of that promise of what role playing could be. And I think I'm always trying to achieve that expectation of that 10-year-old kid. But I went on to play AD&D, Call of Cthulhu in the 80s, and then really fell out of it once I went to college and played a little bit and then moved overseas. And I just didn't find a role-playing game community to latch onto. So for 12 years of my life, I kind of did some, you know, we'll talk about it later, but lonely play where you sort of absorb RPG content but didn't get into it. Moving back to the States... was right around the time 4th edition was coming out, and I just didn't latch onto it. That's not a comment on the quality of the system. It has its charms for sure. But then it got back into 5e.
So when you were out of the U.S., you were in the like Southeast Asia area?
Yeah, so I actually I moved overseas to teach at a university. And again, I was teaching internet development design and ended up having a sort of an accidental career in advertising with a brief tour through anthropology, weirdly. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that I just didn't have a chance to really dig into a lot of role-playing games at that point. But
well, and your teaching background intersected with your role-playing background not so long ago.
Yeah. So back here in the States, so after, dipping in and out of software and continuing my tech and design work, I ended up working at a middle school, a girls' middle school here in Seattle. And that was a big moment because I somehow convinced them to start a D&D club, which was actually weirdly, you would think it would be fine now that we're in the 2000s. But even now, there was like some question about whether or not this was a satanic thing.
And this is pretty Critical Role, I think, when you started that.
Yeah, it was just before Critical Role.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And, you know, we started a D&D club with, I think we had like six girls sign up in this middle school.
And then by the end, I remember because my daughter went to this school that it was like the most oversubscribed club. Like,
yeah.
Ethan and I really met because I reached out to him to try to make sure that my daughter would get into the club.
Yeah. Right. There may have been a bribe. I don't know.
There may have been. Yeah.
And I think that the condition was that you would, if you can come help to run some games,
that's
which
right.
You ended up doing.
Which was awesome.
Yeah. We had about 40% of the school. And that was actually, that was the peak of that program.
Wait, 40%? Of the middle school was playing D&D.
Was playing D&D. Yeah.
That's incredible.
I mean, we were running three groups at one point. So.
Yeah. And, there was an elaborate system. Maybe one of our episodes, we can talk a little bit about kids and play. But, we had an elaborate system of DMs picking DMs. And, we had little ceremonies for the girls when they became
fantastic.
A DM. It was great.
That's so cool.
So that's my background. And I've really... over the past couple of years have branched out into a lot of other non-D&D role playing.
Yep.
That's really, I would say, where my interest lies now, and still have great love for the original, the OG, but a lot of other opportunities out there for gaming with you folks.
I think out of the three of us, I think I am the least nostalgic, right? Where I have that old experience is like, oh, that's dead for me. How do I get some new, better thing? I'm always the shiny new. Yeah.
And I'm the one who's like off finding like old Judges Guild modules to go read. Yeah.
Yep.
Oh, nostalgia. There's a whole episode right there.
Yep. Totally. And then just to point out that I think we will also occasionally be having other hosts on the show. And so we'll introduce them as they come and we look forward to having
them. Yeah. We've already
people.
Tried to rope our buddy Brendan in. I think we'll be seeing him. Yep. He's another member of our sort of gaming group here.
Yep.
And also just to clarify, like we all do game together regularly.
Yep.
That's right. That's right.
So, we'll try to avoid any sort of inside, information or jokes, but, we're at the table all the time.
Yep.
Yeah, that's right.
Yep.
Let's move on to the next section now. We are calling it Appendix X.
So Appendix X is a reference for those of you who don't realize it to Appendix N in the original. Which version of D&D did
it was the first edition of AD&D?
Yep.
Dungeon Master's Guide.
And that was a list of all of the mostly books, but like fantasy books that had influenced the Dave and Gary in creating D&D. And for us here.
Nice shout out to Dave. Yeah. I don't think that he gets enough out in that edition.
Put him first.
Or any.
So we're going to have Appendix X every episode. And the goal here is for us to talk about what is the other media that we're consuming that is influencing our game and making our play better or more interesting or what we're thinking about. So, Ethan, you want to talk about where you are?
Sure. So in terms of gaming, I'm doing, besides role-playing gaming, you folks have been talking endlessly about Disco Elysium. Yeah. I finally picked it up.
So good.
It's an amazing RPG video game, and the quality of the writing and the world building is
so good.
Kind of staggering.
Now, did I hear correctly that that was actually based off of a group of people's role-playing game campaign?
Yeah. And I think it was actually a D&D campaign even.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah.
Oh, I didn't realize it was D&D.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's fascinating to me how, and again, this is about the maturity of the medium, but just as a segue for a moment, the number of mass media properties, IP out there today that have been spawned from role-playing games or like homebrew campaigns, like The Expanse, which was a series of books before it was a TV show, and before it was a series of books, it was a big set of binders of world building for a role-playing game campaign.
I had no idea about that.
Well, even if you look at Starfield, the game coming out from Bethesda this year, you know, the Todd Howard, the director of that game, has talked about how that's all based off of his Traveler campaign from the 80s. Like, that's that's the primary kind of, you know, inspiration for it all.
Me and my son, we love horror shows, and we just watched Archive 81, Archive 31.
Oh, yeah.
And that is based off of a Delta Green campaign.
Oh, no way. Right. First, it was a podcast.
Okay.
And before it was a podcast, it was a Delta Green campaign.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So totally agree.
Besides video games, I'm reading a book called Only Yesterday, which is, it was written in the 1930s. Feels like it was written in, it could have been written 10 years ago. And it is a history of the 1920s. And I'm reading that specifically to sort of cover off, you know, Call of Cthulhu history and world building stuff.
That's really cool. Yeah. Well, speaking of books, you know, you, Eric, mentioned Dave Arneson earlier. I just finished reading Game Wizards, which is a book on kind of the history of early TSR to mid period TSR, but with a focus on kind of the protracted public and also legal battle between Gygax and Arneson about the authorship of D&D. So really fascinating book, really kind of gets you in the mindset of just how small the gaming community was during this era of playing. I mean, you're talking little hobby clubs in specific cities that are really the ones cobbling together rules. You know, one of the more fascinating parts of it was just how much rules, RPG rules, were viewed as something that was a bizarre idea for a business to get into, because all the money to be made was in miniatures.
Totally.
Right? And they would just package rules for free along with some miniatures, because they're like, well, I guess you need some sort of rules to play with your little figures. And boy, has that changed.
Yeah. Although I feel like maybe Wizards of the Coast is still having a little bit of that battle with the recent changes they've been doing to their licensing.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. That's true. I will say the other thing I've been playing recently is a video game called Road Warden. I think all of us at the table are fans of the game Citizen Sleeper, which was a great kind of mechanics forward, but also story forward video game from last year. Road Warden, similar in style, but it's a kind of a dark, dour fantasy world. And it leans a little bit more towards choose your own adventure. You know, what that's really helping me when I think about kind of bringing things to the table is, unlike, say, a Disco Elysium, where you can maybe go anywhere at any moment and, you know, it's free form kind of exploration within dialogue trees, Road Warden really is more like a choose your own adventure. And so the choices are really kind of stark. And one of the things that I find I often have to do just as a DM at the table is your table kind of loses its way sometimes talking, and you almost need to represent to them. Feels like you are all talking about three different choices you need to make here, right? And kind of box them in a little bit. So that's been a fun game to play, just to watch how it plays with kind of communicating player choice.
Now, a Citizen Sleeper, I remember, and this was what you said to me when you told me about the game, largely as being kind of Blades in the Dark like, in that only because they were so focused on clocks, and in the game it's all about like what choices you make. And is this new one, Road Warden, is it the same way?
The clocks are perhaps present, but they're hidden.
Okay.
So there's definitely things that happen, you know, over the course of a number of days. You're, you know, a road warden who's walking around this peninsula, patrolling a peninsula. But in Citizen Sleeper, it, like Blades in the Dark, it is showing you the clocks, right?
Yep.
And I think both of them share something in common, where in Citizen Sleeper, one of the things that makes it hard for people to get into that game, I feel, is it starts when you're in really dire straits and you're barely surviving every day.
Yep.
And Road Warden's very similar. And it reminds me a little bit more of when we've done like Hex Crawls, where you're just barely eking through, you know, every day. And the payoff comes in, the feeling of power comes as you gain the kind of that mastery and additional power. So, but that payoff is much later.
Yeah.
So.
Actually, I'm all about that tension in the moment before you get the power. Just like that is so interesting and powerful to me.
Yeah, it's, I agree.
Like the beginning of the original Dark Sun campaign a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Good reference.
Yeah. Something I want to mention for the listeners is that we all have very different game master style. So Eric, when you're saying like, oh, that moment of tension is really important to me. Like I 100% know exactly. Like when you say that, I can think of moments that you have GM'd for us where I'm like, oh yeah, that's Eric, like playing with tension, modulating
tension. We're on the
knife's
edge, right?
Yeah.
And I don't know, like, I actually feel like I could describe your mode of GMing better than Jason and myself. Uh-huh. I'm not sure how we would summarize it, because Eric's all about tension.
Yeah, mine, I would say, definitely is I emphasize the rule of cool more than anything.
Right.
If the players are coming up with something that I think is going to add just an amazing, fun part of the narrative that we're going to remember for a long time, I will play fast and loose at those rules and the roles in order to get us that moment.
Yep.
Because that moment to me is what we remember for years afterwards.
Yeah.
So that's kind of more of the DMing style I try to go for.
Yeah, I think we should talk about that later on in this episode when we maybe some of those key moments we can come back to.
I totally agree. I feel like also too, Jason, you, and I think this is an alignment, that you have a real focus on the character development of the PCs at the table.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right? And that's hard, and that's not the GM's responsibility.
Right.
But I definitely feel like it's something that shines in the games that you play.
Thanks. Yeah, you want to create an arc, right?
Yep. Yeah, that's totally right.
Whereas I would say, Ethan, the way I would describe your style is the world building is really deep. You know, you ran an incredible Yellow King, the Robin Laws game. And I felt like there was so much more to that Paris than we ever explored.
Yep.
And that is a rare feeling when playing a game. So
that's great. Yeah. Yeah. If I had to pick a style for myself, it would be world building forward.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Yep. And I would definitely say, I think that, because I think about even the purest Gumshoe Trail of Cthulhu game that you had run for us. What I recall really well is the sense of awe, right?
Interesting.
This, there's something bigger than us.
I was
us.
So nervous. That was the first time you roped me into running that session.
That's right.
There's a specific method of Saltwell roping people in to to doing things. You're gonna run this session, aren't you? Good luck. And I was so nervous because I didn't understand Gumshoe, and I'm still not sure I understand Gumshoe after having run many Gumshoe campaigns. We'll do an episode about that.
Yeah, I'm definitely there with
for
you.
For sure.
Yeah. Yep.
I think that leads us right into the next section,
which is
kind of the meat of this episode, was talking about the nature of fun. You know, we wanted to kind of tackle this right away because the reason that we're all getting around the table is to have fun with our friends. You know, sometimes I hop on some of these various RPG forums and I hear tales of people's tables and they sound miserable. You know, one of the things that I think sometimes get lost along the way is people think that the job at the table is the mechanical job, following the rules versus necessarily having fun. And so we thought we would kind of tease apart what makes it fun at the table from a player perspective, from a GM perspective, and then just kind of as a group perspective when you're all together. Yeah. Anyone else have any comments on why fun as a topic is interesting?
I think I'm amplifying you when I say that if you don't understand the type of fun that you're creating at the table, then your ability to create it is, of course, going to be less.
Yeah. That's a good way to put it.
This was a big change in my thinking, actually, you know, from as we slowly evolve out of sort of childhood RPG experiences. You know, as a kid, it was really, we really focused on just what is this weird thing? What are these rules? We have to apply these rules.
Yeah.
Right.
And somehow we still managed to have fun, which may have actually been accidental or incidental to the whole process of you can't do that or you can do that. The rule of cool was not a thing for us.
No. Yeah.
Whereas today that's everything for me.
Yeah, yeah. Absolutely.
So
absolutely.
Would you say that maybe some of the reason that early days fun is that just the novelty of role playing was enough?
Yeah. For me and my group as kids, I mean, I would say we were constantly looking things up in a rule book. I feel like we were, also I just think our capacity to understand the rules was less, right?
Yeah.
Although I think you could make that argument about me now as well. But I would say that it was just cool that we were even playing D&D.
Yep.
That was what was the fun, the thrill of it.
Yep.
Whereas now we're adults and, you know, the things that we're looking for is not just did we play that thing. It is what was the experience like? And I think that to me is part of what changed it.
That's really interesting.
Yeah, for us, I grew up, we would play superheroes all the time running around our small town.
Mm.
So you're not talking about the role-playing?
No, not role-playing, but just pretending to be Spider-Man.
And, we did that all the time.
Yeah. Right? I think that's a typical, childhood activity. And there were rules to that, but the experience of playing D&D was just somehow so much more magical. And I think it was because we had a book.
Yep.
Yeah, that's right.
And we
that's
sensed right. that inside, trapped inside of that book, there was a whole world or worlds.
Yeah.
Yeah, so just that magic, I think that was enough to sustain us for sure.
Yeah, and I think right now, you know, we're talking about kind of the emotions of fun, but there's a lot of different people who've tried to canonize that or kind of create a system to describe right. how fun works. And so, Eric, I think you've done more reading about this than anyone I know.
Yeah. Sure. So I think that there's a few systems of a few frameworks that people use to talk about fun. The most prominent one by far in terms of like getting the most academic cred was Ron Edwards in the early days of the Forge had created what he called the GSN framework, which is really half a description of fun, but it's half a description of players. And so that stands for gamist, simulationist, narrativist. And the thought was that some people or, you know, some of the fun comes from narrative, and I think that's largely correct. I think some of it comes from being a game, and some people, right, really, you know, Ethan, you just talked about having the book, and one of the values of having the book is it meant, oh, I might not win, right? And it became challenge, and so that sense of game was also very big. And then the third one was simulationist. And I actually think this one, I don't know if like the Forge community or Ron would agree with me on this, but the simulationist, I think, really has gone by the wayside. It was the fact that in those early days, so many people came from wargaming.
That's right.
Right. That yeah. there were people who thought, oh, I want to apply this the same way I applied chainmail or whatever it was. I really think today there aren't a lot of people who really, when they think of simulationist, it either becomes a part of the gamist fun, which is like by sticking to something real world, like, oh, if this is doable in the real world, then I can do it in the game. That mm-hmm. increases the challenge, or it increases the story element where it's like a role playing thing where I want to embody what it was really like to be a Civil War sharpshooter yeah, right. or something.
Yeah, that simulationist part of the genre of the history of the hobby.
Yep.
You know, I love that you tied it into wargaming because it really was. We're just playing another war game. It just happens to be with individual units
yep.
as opposed to, you know, at the platoon or the squad level or whatever. And yeah, maybe there's some story elements, but what we're trying to do is figure out how these units would move through a dungeon, let's say, yep. right, and fight these monsters. It's interesting that that GSN framework is very player motivation focused
it
because,
is.
You know, that's exactly what you see in the Richard Bartle stuff where he talks about. And this was a paper that he wrote a long time ago about MUDs, multi-user dungeons, that I think many people have had experience in, but they were text-based kind of versions of World of Warcraft back in the day.
Yep.
And that framework really focuses on player motivation as well. And he frames it as killers, achievers, explorers, and socializers. And it's really, you know, you're playing a game as a player in order to fulfill some sort of desire. So a killer really enjoys killing monsters or other players. Achievers like to make progress. They like to see their character progress and those numbers go up, right? Explorers like to understand everything that's going on in the world. They're the ones who will look at a mountain and be like, well, let's go find out what's over there. Or the reason they want to go in the dungeon is not necessarily to get gold, but to find out the mysteries that are in that dungeon. And then finally, the socializers, they're there for kind of talking to other people. Now, I think all of us kind of, you know, that move in between all of these different motivations. You know, what interested me about when 5th edition came out is they try to kind of click stop back a bit. And it wasn't so much about player motivation, but it was here are kind of three modes of fun that happen in this system.
I think that's super interesting.
Yeah.
I did have a question for you about the Bartle thing, though.
Yeah.
Do you think that those four types, the like killer, achiever, explorer, socializer, do you think they all apply? Because it was for MUDs. Do you think they all apply equally well to RPGs, or there are some that are an easier fit when thinking about tabletop role playing?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think they all apply. I mean, killer, you definitely see a lot of games where if there's not some sort of combat happening,
yeah,
you know, I think maybe your players sometimes leave disappointed, right? Yeah. Not necessarily our players at our table or all tables, but there's, I think, many tables out there where the combat is the thing, yep. right? And then I would say that for the achievement motivation, that's really what they want to see. They want to see their individual characters progress.
Yeah.
Where I think RPGs are often the weakest, oddly enough, is in the exploration part.
I agree.
Yeah, that is a part that, you know, they describe these amazing worlds that everybody wants to go learn about and explore. But mechanically, there's not a lot of heft there unless you kind of dip into like the simulationist world of like a hex crawl or something like that.
Yep.
And then I think socializing is a great part if you have a table where you can get player-to-player interaction happening. And that's not the easiest thing for a game master to kind of coax to happen on the table. And it's not always the most comfortable thing for players to do. They sometimes have a difficult time getting into a headspace where the fun can be generated from player to player versus being received from the game master.
I think, though, too, there's Jane McGonigal in Reality is Broken. She talked about playing together alone, which is like happens in World of Warcraft all the time. And I used to live in New York City, and I loved in New York City this feeling of being together alone. Like I was surrounded by, you know, 10 million people, but I didn't have to talk to any of them, but I still felt a part of it. And I feel like in role-playing games, even if they're not doing, like player-to-player interaction is clearly the stronger socialization. But even if you're not doing that, I feel like it's just a structured way for people to get together and socialize. And there's, even if we're all playing together alone and it's just you and Ethan, the GM, and then me and Ethan, the GM, that it's still a, it can have some social aspect.
Yeah.
Interesting.
So would you say RPGs fall into like the pizza rule where even like bad pizza is still good pizza because it's pizza?
I definitely think when I was 16, it was definitely the pizza rule. I think that maybe I'm a little more discriminating with my time now.
Interesting. I had never heard the pizza rule before, but I'm going to cite it. I'm going to cite it all the time now. Yeah. Yep.
So, Jason, I had interrupted you. You were talking about 5E and kind of how 5E.
Yeah, those three pillars.
Yeah.
5E, I think, does a good job of laying out these pillars of how fun works or attempts to work within the 5E system. And that is exploration, role play, and social. And I think, you know, we covered kind of some of this ground, but really it's exploration is the one where, boy, is that a tricky one to pull off.
Like if you had to rewrite 5E, and I mean, somebody is somewhere,
right?
You know, they're sweating too. Yeah, boy, right. Their hand is shaking as I put pen to paper.
That's right.
I'm not sure that you put exploration in there. Like, I mean, is it one of the three pillars? Like is drama one of the three pillars now?
That's
like if you had to recreate, you know, D&D and recast those core elements, I'm not sure that it makes the cut.
Yeah. And why do you think it is that it doesn't? I think that's super interesting.
You know, going back to what we were talking about at the top of this segment about, or when you were talking about simulationist theory, Jason, you were reading the going back and going through the early Dragon magazines.
Yeah, that's right. I have been. Yeah.
And I spent many a day skipping school and going to the university where my mom worked to read Dragon magazines in the library.
I love it.
Oh my God, there was literally a university across the street from my high school, and I would go to their cafeteria and just read all that. Like, that was like a super big experience.
Yeah, it's the fact that they had them in a library lent them both like credence and like authority.
Oh, sure.
At this university, I was like, oh yeah, university students read this stuff.
It's and part it's of the adult world.
Yeah, it's an academic thing. Yeah. So I'm totally justified in skipping school to read that. I remember reading through and Xeroxing page after page of tables of simulation material.
That's right.
And it was always like, okay, if you're in a windstorm,
right, you know, exactly.
Or if you're, we're going to simulate weather conditions,
that's
you know,
right.
And they would go into, there was a ton of that material.
Yep.
You do not see that anymore.
You
don't think.
No.
At least it doesn't seem to be the popular material.
I'm so with you on this. And I love your flip into if you were rewriting it. That's such a good provocative question, because I do think that you would probably pick something like drama instead of exploration. Because the other thing I would say is I think players have a hard time holding some of the world building in their head that would make exploration pay off in an interesting way. I'll just kind of, you know, talk about our table briefly. I can barely get you all to remember the names of non-player characters at the time, right?
For sure.
Let alone that they're from like the land of Gondor, right? Like they'll be like, whatever, you know?
Yep. So. I think too, there's an element of about what makes it hard. I think there's an element of aesthetics that if you look at video games, right, mm-hmm. where I think exploration, like a game like Firewatch, has very strong exploration mechanics, but that's because they have such strong visual aesthetics in a way that is super hard to do in role-playing games.
Yeah, there's a payoff for exploration.
Right. Yeah. I mean, Skyrim, you can just walk around.
That's right.
That's right.
And it's beautiful.
And it's beautiful, and you're just kind of in awe of it.
Yeah.
I think, now that's interesting because this may come back to GM styles, but I wonder whether or not the, you know, one of the experiments I used to do or trainings I used to do with the girls in the middle school was to have them do the five senses as game masters. Yeah. And I would present them with either a written or visual or something like that, you know, some sort of prompt, and have them describe it to somebody else using all five senses.
Yep.
Three senses is not too hard. Three senses, not too hard. But, you know, when you start getting into like how things feel or even how they smell, like those are not common senses that are necessarily brought up at the table. And I wonder whether or not there is something about game masters who can present all that kind of exploration material using a very rich, like, can you create Skyrim in your players' minds?
You know, I would say one of the things where WotC really did a good job attempting to do this with exploration was using that exact kind of sensory description you just mentioned. And that was in the Curse of Strahd adventure. There's actually an entire chapter at the beginning that's largely just lines and phrases that you can use and pepper throughout it.
Right.
Really well done. Yeah. Really well done.
I think an interesting case study is, and I'd like to ask a question of the table about in a second about why do you think WotC keeps it in? Why is it important to them? But if you look at Five Torches Deep, which is a relatively new kind of half OSR, half modern game, but what they do is they take a different approach, which I think also Dungeon World takes, which is don't try to add in the aesthetics to make exploration interesting. Don't try to add mystery. Instead, add game. And so they do it by, like, in Five Torches Deep, you're always, your actions are using up cargo and that resource management game of like, am I going to live through being out in the forest is how they bring exploration back.
Which isn't a simulation attempt.
No, it's a game attempt.
That's right. Exactly. Yeah.
Okay. And for the benefit of our listeners, clarify why it is not simulation and why it is game. Because you're simulating a torch, but it's not that in this case.
That's right. So, and in fact, so I'll start maybe by talking a little bit about the rule. It'll be even clearer. In Five Torches Deep, they abstract away and have a concept of cargo, which is torches and food and arrows. And when you do things, you just end up using cargo. And so it's not an attempt to simulate, but instead it's an attempt to add tension. And when I think of gaming, it's like I could fail during the exploration phase because, like, Jason, when we were doing Saltmarsh, right?
Yeah.
And you're like, oh my gosh, like the T-Rex knocked all of our cargo out.
That's
and
right.
Now all of a sudden we have no cargo and it becomes a real scramble and you have to get creative to think about how do I live through it? How do I win from a game perspective? It is a type of hard fun that we'll get into in a little bit.
Yeah. And what Eric's referencing is we did during the pandemic, when the pandemic first started, you know, we had lost our ability to have an in-person table. And so we hopped on Discord and I ran a Ghost of Saltmarsh session. In the midst of it, I decided to add the Isle of Dread, the old classic module Isle of Dread.
Yeah, as one does.
Yeah, as one does.
Right? What does this need here? Maybe a little Isle of Dread.
That's right. And you know, that, you know, very much hex crawl simulationist way of exploration.
Yeah. I'm going to just toss out hypothesis for some back burner, let it, you know, lay fallow for now. But I wonder whether or not simulation is not really part of the tripod, but whether or not it must always function as a support or mechanism by which you develop either the gamified component
or the story component.
Or the story component.
That's right. That's a good way to put it.
I totally agree with that.
Yeah. Somebody's shaking their head. Some listener right now is shaking their head. No. all right. So before we lose this section, though, I thought we should talk, maybe somebody mentioned drama and we should maybe talk a little bit about Robin D. Laws.
Yes. Before we get there, I had just a quick question at the table because I think everybody gets that the role playing element of RPGs is strong. The combat element is strong. The exploration is weak. You know, like people talk about it all the time.
Yeah.
Why do you think WotC is, and I don't think it's just WotC, why do you think people really want to make it? Like, why not just drop it?
Why not just drop the
exploration as being something that you try to do in a game?
I have a theory on this.
Yeah, go for it.
And by the way, WotC is Wizards of the Coast.
Right.
Yeah.
Seattle-based company.
And it skips ahead maybe a little bit to the next session, which is, I think for game masters, the exploration that's happening is actually like kind of more in their heads, right? They're the ones who've read all the flat books and all the source books. They know the different kingdoms of Greyhawk, and they know that you just met an NPC that actually has a rich history that they've written down in their yellow legal pad, you know, that's GM fun, I think, more than it is player fun. I think the players only are like, okay, that seems like maybe an important person. But for the GM, they're like, oh, you have no idea. That person used to, you know, and they have like a whole background maybe. So
I think that's really astute. I think that's really, really great. So sorry, I interrupted you, Ethan.
Not at all. No. I'm just head nodding the whole time basically saying that, you know, I was thinking, we'll get back to this when we talk about fun for game masters, but I think that it is a risk that game masters take what has been fun for them and try and make it fun for the players.
Yes. You will love this backstory I created.
Yeah. If you just venture over the next three barren plateaus,
yep.
There is a cool city that I built.
Yep. I spent hours.
Yeah. It took me a year.
Right.
Yeah.
You better get there. Going back, we talked about those models from Bartle about, players, achievers, explorers, socializers, right? Player types. And that reminded me of Robin D. Laws, game designer and writer, or writer and game designer. I never remember what order that goes in. And he designed a number of games and the Gumshoe system, which I love, although maybe don't understand, but love. And he has a book that came out ages ago in term game time and game years. Game years are like dog years, by the way. called the Robin's Rules of Good Game Mastering. Robin's Laws of Good Game Mastering, a play on his name. You know, he has one overarching rule, which is that it's role-playing games are really entertainment and they should be entertaining, which is something that surprisingly people forget all the time. And that goes back to like our, you know, applying the rules, right?
Yeah.
But he created a list of player types, which was a little bit more nuanced, I guess. Although I really like Bartle's simplified model. I think that's the one I would gravitate to.
Uh-huh.
But this might be splitting some hairs in that model, where he lists things like the power gamer. And these are the guys who want to buff.
Mm-hmm.
They want to mac. They're min-maxers, right, as we say.
Yep.
Butt kickers, people who just want to like go out and hack and slash.
Yeah.
They might be a wizard, but they're going to go out and hack and slash.
Yeah, they'll be your barbarian characters,
yep.
Right?
Yeah. Tacticians, the guy who reads a lot of military history.
Yep.
And it shows at the table. And that could be fun, but that's the sort of your war gamer route, right?
Totally.
Specialist, that would be somebody who favors a particular character type. They only and ever play the ranger. Or the druid, whatever. The method actor, which is interesting because the method actor is now also a whole industry.
Yes.
Yeah.
In actual plays.
It might be bigger than the entire RPG industry itself at this point.
And I think we should have we'll probably have an episode where we talk about this.
I think that would be great. Yes. We talked about that, like there's two games. There's the player game and the GM game.
Yeah.
And I feel like the actual play is a third thing.
Oh, Great point.
Yeah. And very important in the industry now, obviously. There's the storyteller, and that is a little bit like the method actor, but more inclined toward the role-playing side and less, I guess, less involving any sort of simulation. We'd dig into that a little bit more. But then there's also the casual gamer, which is sort of the, I don't want to say they're the person who lean backs, but they're just there to have fun, roll some dice occasionally.
Be with some friends.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. And he also has a whole model of analyzing role-playing games based around what he calls story beats, which are this kind of back and forth seesaw between fear and hope.
Yeah.
Feels like I'm describing my life. But
I think that is a great lead into the next segment, which is that all of these so far, I think we agree, are mostly talking about player types and player motivations, but maybe not necessarily underneath that are really types of fun that people have when they fulfill those motivations.
Mm-hmm.
And so we wanted to talk a little bit about what are those types of fun. And to do that, we talked about what is a role playing and what are its roots, what are its inspirations, and that there are three. There is narrative and story. Clearly, that is a huge part. Like, look at the GSN framework. It is a game, right? Again, look at the GSN framework. And that also, you know, something that's a little different than like a board game, even a board game that has a lot of backstory, is about improv. Mm-hmm. And so I wanted to take a second and look at each of those. And I think, you know, we wanted to look at each of those and say, what are the things that are fun about each of those? So I'm going to just open it up for you guys and say, let's start with story. What is fun about story? Like, why is it fun for all of us? Like, you know, there's a bazillion articles out there about, oh, it's hardwired into us and it's so instinctual that we all love narrative, and narrative is the way you make your point in business. But why do we love story? What is it about story that's fun? What do you guys think?
I think the thing that's fun about story at the table is that you, as a player, you have agency in it, right? And that you're, you know, you're... group, as a group, you're collectively storytelling together. And, you know, we've definitely had stuff at our table where, you know, the vibe will shift in the story and then everyone kind of builds onto it. You know, we had a moment in a Call of Cthulhu campaign recently where the horror really ramped up and you saw everybody kind of lean into the horror of the moment. You know, I've also had things at the table where things got very psychedelic and people lead into the psychedelic and weird of it. And so to me, I think it's less the actual sentences of the story and even the mechanical, does the story pay off or does it follow any of the rules of storytelling? As much as it is, the players have participated in that story and they feel like they're authoring something together, which is something we rarely get to do in our lives when it comes to stories and fiction.
Yep, I agree. Yeah. I agree. I think that's also a little bit of the comes from that improv background, right? Because that's also an attempt to make a story. But I really like the what you were saying about like, oh, when the horror moment came, when the stuff really hit the fan, that tension and stress, like... you know, you can go online and I think on YouTube, there's a great clip of Kurt Vonnegut talking about the shapes of stories. It's literally called The Shape of Story. And in it, he more or less says every story is just there is a situation. It has tension. The tension builds and it builds and it builds. And then the climax is its resolution. Right. And that's kind of, I think, what Robin was also talking about in Story Beats.
Yeah. And a little in more of a fractal manner, I think,
that's
because
right.
That's the large, that's the macro. And then the micro is this constant seesawing between the two.
Yeah,
that's right. I think that that's totally right. But I think that that tension is such a hardwired in us. Like we always are attending to the things that are stressful and tense and I think that is super powerful, both in gaming and in stories. I don't know, Ethan, you have any thoughts?
Yeah. So for me, fiction. So when we talk about story, and you know, I immediately think about fiction. Fiction is always about, for personally, I've looked at it as a way to experience a map to potential future states or potential future selves for me. So and that may be, you know, it's often very character and situational. It may not have any direct relevance to my life, but it's a way of experiencing what ifs I was in this situation. And there is something very satisfying and similar to that when we're at the table and we're all crafting a story together and it is emergent. And I have a character that is experiencing that. It is that map to that future potential self or future potential state.
Yeah.
So. And I think that that's a big deal. You know, that was not how we played when we were kids, at least not intentionally. I think we were sort of groping our way towards it.
Right.
But that's definitely an enormous difference to how I play today.
Yeah. It does give me insight into, as a player, when I watch you, the types of characters you create. You know, like, you know, I would say like in our current one, you know, you're a foreign correspondent, right?
Yeah.
And you can, it's almost like I can see you trying on that mask for a bit and seeing what that looks like.
Yeah,
right.
It's definitely how I approach it.
Yeah.
And so, and I think there's a Berkeley review of the science of stories. And one of the things they talk about is that people who experience stories two things really that they call out. One is that you release the hormone oxytocin, which is like often referred
to. Maybe you do. That's gross.
Yeah, exactly. It is the hormone that women release when they breastfeed. It's often called the love hormone. It is the hormone that is released that gives you the feeling of trusting and bonding with people. And the other thing they find is that there's a set of cells in your prefrontal cortex called your mirror neurons, which are like when you watch someone swimming, the part of your brain related to swimming fires, and so do the mirror neurons. If you watch somebody writing, then the part of your brain related to writing fires, so do the mirror neurons. And what they're really getting at there is, I think what you're saying, Ethan, that emotional bond and putting yourself in that character is core to what story is, and I think is like such a natural fit for role playing because it, I mean, it's in the name, right?
Yeah,
role playing.
Yeah, right. Yep.
The other thing that they talk about is, or the other thing actually that I want to bring up, I'm not sure that they talk about this, is I think for stories, we are so hardwired to be curious, right? To learn and that element of mystery, which is amazing to me that it's not in the 5e pillars, is not mystery. That sense of curiosity, that sense of and also awe, right? These are very related. Stanford did a study where they looked at awe, which they defined as seeing something bigger than you, right? You look out and you see the night sky and you're like, oh my gosh, what's going on there? You feel awe, right? Or you see, you go to Niagara Falls and you see this giant waterfall and you think, oh wow, so bigger than me. Often it's this nature thing. And we know, and what they found was that people who experienced awe exhibited the same behaviors that people who are curious exhibit. And to me, we were talking about exploration, and it seems like, and again, this is Ethan, I think what you do so well, but it seems to me that awe should be like our home court when it comes to role playing games, right? Like, And that could be the, like, don't focus on what color are the leaves. I actually, just to be clear, Ethan, I picked up your five senses trick from when, when you did it at school, and I love it. But that we really need to bring in this, like, bigger piece of awe. Right. I think when Mike Shea talks sometimes.
Yeah, I was just thinking about his Sly Flourish with his fantastic locations, and he's really an advocate for that. Go big. Be impressive, you know, kind of overwhelm your characters with the sense of awe.
That's right. And so I think like story, you think about curiosity.
Yeah.
You think about tension and stress and you think about emotional bond. That feels to me like all three things that are both central to why people love narratives and why people love role playing.
Yeah.
I love it.
So the next thing I think that we talked about was about games. Right. And what is fun about, because D&D, well, I think it's an open question. I struggle with this all the time. Like you said, Ethan, about struggling some a little bit with like Gumshoe and mystery. I really struggle with, is role playing a game? And I know we're going to have a future episode on failure, so I'm going to hold most of my thoughts there.
Yeah.
But let's assume for a second it is a game. What do you think is it about being a game that is fun for people?
I think there's a, you know, we have a player at our table who has a lucky D20 that he calls Cherry Red.
Yeah.
You know, and there's these high stakes moment where he's not just rolling Cherry Red. He stands up from his chair and his hand hovers over, you know, the table.
Yeah.
And he's shaking, you know, the die in his hand before he rolls it. And you can tell that that moment is pure fun. From a pure game kind of system perspective, in a sense. What is that die going to do? And is my character going to succeed or fail based off of what just happened? And that's why I appreciate having some sort of mechanical heft in a game. Because I think that's what creates those moments. I think that without that, you're doing a, you know, an improv game for a theater troupe before, you know, they go off, you know, go practice a scene or whatever, right?
Totally.
I want some mechanicalness there.
Yep.
And I think that's what creates you're a special kind of tension that gets resolved that isn't about a story.
Yeah.
You know, that is, it's a purely mechanical pleasure to win or
it's
fail
just
something.
Challenge, right?
That's right. That's a good way
it's
to
funny.
It.
I think of that, those, you know, like from story beats, I think about Fear and Hope as very narrative and story related. I mean, obviously the book that Robin D. Laws wrote was called Story Beats.
Yep.
Or Beating the Story. But that's interesting because that's a Fear and Hope moment.
Yeah.
That's purely game, purely mechanical.
That's right. Yeah. That's right.
Yep. I think too, so there's a game designer named Paul Tsigi. I think that's how you pronounce his name. I have no idea. But he said something that now the industry refers to as the Tsigi principle, which is it is not as enjoyable to overcome challenges that you yourself created. I think this is why trad kind of traditional RPGs where you have a GM who plays the rest of the world or the opponent
the
or
obstacle.
Whatever
you,
the thank you. That is such a good way to say it, is so important.
Yeah.
And I actually think it's both important from a, it sets up the challenge. And like you, Ethan, again, you were talking about that book, right? And how having the book was different than just playing superheroes. And it's because when I play superheroes, I'm just overcoming the challenges that I myself created.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I also think it's that role of having the GM there is so important for curiosity, because if we think that overcoming challenges I myself created is less fun, it's triply the case that finding out the mystery that I myself created is like right. almost nonsensical.
Wrapping your own present.
Thank you. Right. That's a great way to say it, Jason. Right. Thank you. So is it always that? So I think this hard fun is always tied into the, like we hear it, the power gamer, right? Mm-hmm. Is that the only, because, you know, there are games out there that are games like, you're going to know more than I do, Jason, like the casual game set.
Yeah, sure.
Where they're not hard.
Yeah.
Do you mean video games? Or?
In this case, I mean video games. Yes, okay. Thank you.
Yeah, and what those, you know, really try to do is set up as tight of a loop as possible between a player action and a reward.
Can you give me an example of one of the games that you're thinking
about? A match three game, for example. So if you are, you know, playing a game that's a match three game where essentially your goal is to match three things of the same color and then it disappears and you get some points. The way that works exceptionally well is, first of all, the mechanics are incredibly apparent as soon as you see it. As soon as you swipe the first time and you match something, which should happen within the first few seconds, you're going to get a very pleasurable sound. Something's going to happen on the board, right?
Yeah. Get a little hit of dopamine.
You get that little hit of dopamine, exactly, right? So in those types of games, they really kind of try to minimize the mechanical heft as much as possible so they can get right to the tiniest loop between action and reward that they possibly can.
Right.
Yeah.
So my example of this is Fable. I don't know if you guys ever played Fable, but I was playing, I forget, Fable 2 maybe, and there's this thing at the beginning where to make money, you chop wood.
Yeah.
And I must have spent 3 days chopping wood.
Yeah.
And I'm like, what the hell am I doing? I'm chopping wood. My kids play this game, and it's a couch co-op game where you do cooking. And I'm like, what?
Overcooked?
Yeah, Overcooked.
Yeah.
And
they don't cook anything at home.
Yeah, they don't cook anything. They hate cooking, right?
Right.
And Jay McGonigal, again, like in Reality is Broken, she says, like, hey, this, what's interesting here is, like you said, these are actually, every time they give you work, it's like the perfect work. Mm-hmm. It is clear. It's not ambiguous. You know what it is. It's something you can accomplish. And you get immediate feedback that says, here's your hit of dopamine.
And that's where, you know, to keep exploring what makes a game system fun or not.
Yep.
There's some players and GMs that enjoy really complicated game systems, not only just for the system or not only for the simulation part of it, but for the system mastery pleasure.
Right.
That's like kind of hard fun challenge is what you're saying.
That's right. Like I would say Shadowrun. In no way, I think, properly simulates the like the kind of world it attempts to create. It would be my guess, right?
Right.
But I think that it's mechanically baroque enough to the point where people really enjoy that part of it.
I mean, this is the difference between basic D&D and AD&D for
that's
me.
That's a great point. Yeah, you know? Absolutely.
Yep, totally. Yeah. I totally agree with that.
And AD&D being 5e. for me.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. Yeah. Essentially. Yeah.
And which is why there's been such a pushback to things like, you know, OSR,
mm-hmm.
which for, if you're not familiar with that, it's old school revival, or there's a lot of different versions of what that acronym means, but it's basically, you know, reversion to kind of the basic D&D.
So yeah.
Very thin rules, rules light in some cases, but kind of a pure game, fantasy gaming experience.
It's funny. I feel like that's a transition from the challenge is the system mastery. And instead the challenge becomes, because many of those OSR games are very deadly, or they want to be.
Sure.
And
I think mistakenly.
Yeah. And what they're saying is the challenge is in the playing of the level, right? Or the adventure.
Right.
It's not in the metagame of system mastery of like, mm-hmm. if I pick these three feats, then I'm an overpowered god.
I'm going to be honest. I just do not find that fun.
Yeah.
I don't find it fun, and I don't find it fun to play with people who are just obsessed.
Yep.
I don't think anybody at our table is, but that kind of that power gaming just does not interest me.
Yeah.
So does it interest you in other games, like video games, or I don't know that there's a board game that's the equivalent?
Boy, that is a good question.
I tend to just not be a min-maxer overall in any game. You know, it's not, you know, I would say in video games, there are definitely people that say, hey, this is the kind of the exact right build to go make for your character. Right.
Right.
And they do that because they want to overpower everything.
Yeah.
Right.
I will sometimes follow those guides because I'm like, I want this game to be easy.
Right. Yeah. Then it's just like, oh, what do I need to do to set up this game to play fun?
That's exactly.
I have zero interest. I do not want to min-max in video games either.
Yeah.
Like, you know, I'm always a stealth player in video games. I'll like snipe people from very far away and things like that, because it's often a way for me to skirt the need to actually level up in specific
ways. Yeah, that's right. That's right. Yeah.
But do you feel like when you do that, are you making choices for your character that make them a good sniper?
Not overtly.
Okay.
I really, to me, it's just a way of like trying to navigate through. Like, I'm trying to avoid the dumb fights.
Yeah.
What I want is to experience the arc of the whole game.
Yeah.
Find that story, find the growth, find the interesting mystery.
Yep.
And, you know, just min-maxing, and maybe, so the question is min-maxing simulation, I guess, is part of,
I don't think it is.
Or is it just gaming?
I think it's gaming, but it's at that system mastery level, not at the level of like, well, okay, actually, here's a great example. I was playing, gosh, you know what I love? I love the first three times that somebody comes to the table, like they've never played D&D, and the first three times you give them an action, three's an arbitrary number, and you say, what do you do? And those first three times before the system has kind of oppressed them into guardrails,
right?
They just say such creative stuff. It's like,
sure,
so fun. And that is a game too, right? That's not system mastery, but it's still, they're trying to overcome the challenge of the narrative situation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I, you know, I'm going to be honest. When I started teaching the girls to play D&D at LDub, I actually mixed in a bunch of OSR stuff too, a bunch of DCC stuff. Mm-hmm. We started them off as zero level characters.
Oh, you did a funnel?
Yeah. Well, no, I mean, sort of a funnel. Yeah. And a funnel is a DCC term, Dungeon Crawl Classics term, where you have like a very deadly initial level to kind of weed out some characters.
Right. Oh, but you had no player death.
Yeah, I had a rule, which is no player death, which the girls somehow never, they were always afraid the characters were going to die. There was always that tension, despite the fact that they knew I had a rule of that.
Totally.
We played D&D, and we nominally were playing 5e because I wanted them to have ownership over it, but we did a lot of that OSR DCC stuff because I wanted to introduce simplified mechanics and to keep them thinking creatively. And so by starting them at zero level, they didn't have any powers. They didn't have any abilities. They didn't have any feats. They had nothing.
Right.
They literally, we rolled up things like your character has a bar of soap and a piece of chalk.
Oh, I remember that.
And they used the heck out of that bar of soap and a piece of chalk. You'd like, they solved big problems. How do we get across this chasm? You have a piece of string.
Bag of flour.
Yeah. Can we tie the string to the bag of flour and throw it across the chasm? Right. And then like somebody climbs over and pulls it across and we make a rope and, you know, like, that yeah. was their fun. And I think because that was their initial experience, it cemented some of that.
Yeah.
Like they didn't calcify into min-maxing. They didn't calcify into what 3 feats do I have to pick?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I think out of the three of us, I'm the most mechanically inclined. Like mm-hmm. I find the rules the most interesting, and I probably do more min-maxing than you guys do, often because if I play a sniper, I want to play the most snipery sniper I can and mm-hmm. have that experience of the playthrough.
Oh, gotcha.
Yeah, rather than like my son, who's just brand new to D&D, and he loves trying to break the system, mm-hmm. right? Trying to find those two things that's just going to make him so OP.
Interesting.
Because there's a challenge in breaking the system. But I'm, you know, maybe I was like that when I was young. But
well, he's a big Magic the Gathering player, too. So you could see that's where that same kind
yes.
of,
very
you
know, much. Right? Yeah. Yes, very much, very
right.
much.
He wants that card combo.
Yes, yes. What I think you don't find in this type of challenge is really in D&D. Like, we've talked about building tension, but you don't find really hard fun. Like, if you think about Flappy Birds, right, mm-hmm. which is like a game where people would say it is insanely frustrating, but say it as a compliment, mm-hmm. right? And people feel so much pride, right? Like, there's this feeling called Fiero, where it's like, it's the feeling when you hold your arms over your head and you're like, woohoo, I did it!
Mm-hmm.
And that is a feeling that you're playing a game, and when you're role playing, I should be able to foster that in my table, but I feel like it never happens.
Yeah, it's you know, what I would say, to keep kind of going with the Flappy Bird example, you could use another example in video games, which is the Dark Souls series, right?
Exactly.
Right. Where, you know, a lot of the pleasure, or all of the pleasure, I don't want to say all of it, a lot of the pleasure of that game comes from skill development, skill mastery. You're yep. becoming skilled at playing that game, right? And I think that, you know, one of the things that's a little bit strange in RPGs is it doesn't really reward a lot of skill at playing the system.
Yep.
Unless you're the table that's all about combat and choosing feats and min-maxing. That rewards the yep. skill, right?
Yep.
But in our table, I can see why you don't get that feeling, because that's not the kind of table you run,
right?
Or I run, or Ethan runs.
Right. So I think we've talked about stories with emotional bonding and tension and curiosity. We talked about games, which has like hard fun, but it also has this like easy fun, which is about clear productivity. And there's a social fun in games, right, which we've talked about. And then I think there's also this element of improv, which is that mm-hmm. we're all making the story as we go along. And you said, Jason, mm-hmm. that you felt like that is one of the pieces of fun. I think you said that as well, Ethan. And why do you think that? What is fun?
You mean improv?
Yeah. What, you know, like, what is fun about all of us creating the story together?
This is probably an area where I would have said a couple of years ago that it wouldn't be fun. Mm-hmm. I was probably kind of against it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. You know?
For me, every role-playing game is a mystery game. It's all a mystery.
Yeah. So you're saying it's all about the curiosity.
It's all. Yeah, I would have said this, okay?
Yeah, yeah, no, yeah, yeah.
We'll come back to where we are today and where I've landed. But, you know, I would have said, you know, going back to Moldvay Basic, the pink box, that, you know, you're going into the caves of chaos, because that's really, like, you start off in the keep and you're, you know, mm-hmm. you're looking around, you're doing some overland exploration, but you're really going to the caves of chaos. You really want to explore those because, wow, they're mysterious and there's some weird stuff in there.
You've heard rumors.
You've heard rumors, right?
Yeah.
You talk to a mysterious man.
Yeah.
I would have never said that if we all sat down and we had a blank map and we sort of created like, oh, there's a city over there and, mm-hmm. and we're going to collaboratively create its backstory, I would have fallen asleep.
Right.
Because for me, the idea was that there has to be a world. Roguelikes didn't interest me, right, as a video game format.
So is that simulationist?
I think that's authorship. I think Ethan's looking to experience something from an author.
Yeah. Yes, that is what it is. Yeah. It is about the intentionality behind a world mm-hmm. that has been created by another human mind that is then presented to me as like, this is a priori, this exists, and it is a real place that you are now going to explore, which is why, like, you know, if an AI were to generate infinite worlds for me,
yep.
which is a real possibility now,
yep.
I'm not interested.
Yep. Yeah.
There's
yeah.
no intentionality
yes.
behind it. That's purely derivative, randomized stuff.
Yeah.
That's a random walk that got real smart.
That's a good way to put it.
Okay.
Yep.
And I want that authorship. So for me, like I would have actually said, and I'm probably still, part of me is on the fence about this.
Yep.
I have fun collaboratively creating worlds with you guys.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Mm-hmm.
We have done this many times.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
You did it with the characters. Who's yeah, this character?
That's right. That's right.
Yeah. I remember one of these characters we made very clearly now.
Yeah.
More clearly than any other NPC.
Right.
Because we made him together at
That's
the table.
Right. That's right.
And then we interacted with him.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a blast.
Yep.
Yeah.
But he didn't come out of your head. He came out of like the weird head, the collaborative, collective brain.
Well, an improvisational head.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I guess to me, that's where I don't enjoy the improv of acting. Right, exactly, right? And in fact, I even struggle when playing role-playing games. I will usually describe my character as doing something or as saying something rather than verbalizing it, right? I struggle to kind of get into the mode
yeah.
of like inhabiting and acting, right?
Yeah.
And so to me, the improv that I enjoy is actually constantly finding ways to make each other like laugh or to build on top of the story with each other. So, you know, I'll again use our Call of Cthulhu adventures as an example where you all were trying to investigate a foundation that was exploring Egyptian artifacts. And as a DM or GM or whatever, there
yep.
was never this moment where I was like, what would happen if they try to flood, you know, the entire place? And
right.
yet somehow you all concocted an Ocean's 11 like plan where, you know, one group of you were going into the bathroom and causing a minor flood while the other ones went and tried to get some books. And that's improv to me. Like that yeah. was,
and I think that totally yeah. is improv. Like, I yeah. don't think you need acting for improv in the sense that we mean mm-hmm. it here.
Right.
I actually totally agree with you. I think that, and this is actually a big problem with actual plays, right? Is Robin Laws, you said that one of those types of players was like the actor.
Well, the method actor.
Yeah.
He says specifically. Yeah.
Yeah. And out of all of the types that you listed, that is the one that bugs me the most because mm-hmm. I think there is a tendency to think, what's fun is me embodying a character without moving the story forward. And I'm just like, just stop talking or move the story forward.
I love that. Yeah.
Yeah. yeah. There, I think the risk with method actors at the table is that they monologue or that they're presenting their little dramatic scenes.
Absolutely.
Yeah. That game is just for them at that moment.
Yeah.
That's a good
yeah.
way of putting it. That's right. exactly.
So I don't like min-maxers or, you know, power gamers. And I don't, you know, we don't like method actors. Who's left at our table?
Yeah, seriously.
Come on. No, we love you min-maxers and method actors.
So this is great. I feel like we've really talked a lot about the space of players. Mm-hmm. So let's talk a little bit now about GMs. I think we started by saying the fun for GMs is different.
Yeah.
What is it?
You know, I will start with, I do take pleasure in prepping for a session. But the pleasure that I take it in is imagining how cool I think that next session is going to be. And thinking of one or two moments that I'm hoping to hit in it. And, you know, we were talking about the Sly Flourish materials earlier. And I think he's done a great job of helping people get to kind of the prep that matters and giving you enough of a system to kind of go and do some homework without spending 6 hours on, you know, the back history of something that the players will never experience, right? So I do enjoy prepping, but I also find that, you know, I'm so time compressed usually that I give short shrift to the actual, I'm going to sit down at a desk and prep.
Sure.
And that prepping ends up happening more in my imagination in between sessions. What do I think might happen next? What would I do if somebody does something like this,
yep.
right? So that's a definite pleasure for me as a GM.
So, and, you know, I have a recollection of being in high school and I was, I had a fast food job and somebody, one of my players was like, hey, I really appreciate as a GM how much effort you put into prepping, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I said to them, like, I think that's crazy that I get to play this game, you know, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
Yeah.
Like, I'm filling all of my time frying fish, really doing what you just said.
Right.
You only get to play this game like a few hours a day or a week.
It's a great way to put it. And, yeah. And you prep more than any game master I think I've ever met. I mean, you know, you will show up, you know, to a session and you're like, wait, you built like a leather bound book for each of us, you know? and so I always really appreciate, as a player in your games, I know I'm in for a very specific kind of ride with you because of how you prep.
Yep,
and I prep very differently, and that ride's going to be very different.
Yeah,
with my
I mean, let me give another example for our listeners. But Eric, this was not a game that any of us played with you. You played this with a different group, Betrayer. And but you printed, like 3D printed a full like three-dimensional map of the space they were in on a 3D printer. So because it was so complicated, you kind of needed to have this specific prop.
Yeah, it was a four-dimensional dungeon.
It was a four-dimensional print.
Right. And no.
Which explains the feeling of madness that I experienced when I looked at it.
There you go. That's right.
Well, I mean, Eric even went as far as, we had a game, a Red Markets game we were playing that was set in a post-apocalyptic Seattle.
Yeah.
And Eric was calling Seattle businesses attempting to get a hold of blueprints of their business that he
could
use.
I'm sure you're on a list now because of this, Eric.
Totally.
Yeah. So... you know, you're talking about playing 24/7. This, I want to mention that this is a term I think about a lot. And I think this comes from Evil Hat designer and Fate designer Fred Hicks.
Uh-huh.
But it's the concept called lonely fun.
Yeah.
And, you know, for me, when lonely fun is the fun that you have reading the books, reading the role-playing game books, or looking at them, or imagining, like, opening the box and looking at that stuff and thinking, like, oh man, what cool things could happen.
Absolutely.
You know? And we do that sometimes as game masters with books that we will never play.
Mm-hmm.
We do that, you know, I used to sit by our like old wood stove in Wisconsin on winter nights and just page through the Monster Manual, which was the only, like, that came out first.
Yeah.
You know, so I had like Basic and the Monster Manual, and I would just look at these monsters.
Yep.
And the stat blocks didn't match the basic rules. And like that gap between like what made sense and what didn't make sense was just electric. It was like a spark gap.
Wow.
You know?
Yeah.
And that for me was lonely fun.
Yep.
And, you know, we have that all the time. I think that there's a risk in lonely fun, which is the overprep that you can do as a dungeon master, where you create scenarios and you're like, again, you know, you cross those three plateaus, you'll get to this cool city I spent a year building.
That's right.
So I'm going to put you on rails now.
I'm going to make you go over those three hills.
Yeah. And I've done this many times. I do this sometimes still. And I think that the trick is always like, prep can be great, and even like quote unquote overprep, but it's how you apply it at the table.
Yeah.
And if you treat it, Jason, the way you're describing as sort of like imagination, or as like just things that you can like pick, you put your hand down into that box and you can pull something out, like, oh yeah, well, I was thinking about that area of town.
That's right. I love that. Yeah.
You know, or the sewers or whatever.
Yep.
Then you can pull it out and have a dynamic experience at the table.
Mm-hmm. I definitely think there are three types of fun for me for the lonely fun. One is what you guys talked about, which is there's just creative expression. It's like any other craft, right? Building a map or whatever.
Right.
There is the challenge, right? It's a game, right? The game is like, how do I make the best possible adventure or experience for the table? I think that's really the thing that gets me going, that makes me like want to think about it all the time. Or I'm reading the book because I feel like there's a different set of rules. Like, oh, I'm going to go read Powered by the Apocalypse because I want to do fail forward or whatever. I think what you guys do that I don't ever do is like, I hate reading a rule book that I am not going to play, especially like a setting book I'm not going to play is like...
Oh, I love those.
I know.
Yeah.
which is great.
Yeah.
So how do you think this stuff varies at the table? Like, I think, you know, clearly for me, that GMing, like I said, it is a different game. It's about how do I make a great adventure experience. But I think every table, right, Jason, you say this all the time, has its own experience of fun.
Yeah.
And so like what, when you think about fun for a specific table, what do you think about?
Yeah, I think that, you know, I was sending you all some examples of this before this show of different Reddit threads where people, DMs or players, were just miserable, right? They just were in just like, you could just tell that this was not a fun RPG group.
Right.
And it always comes down to expectations being mismatched. And some of these folks have even had session zeros where they've really tried to set expectations together as a table. But, you know, I think that, you know, we talked a little bit about the DM being the obstacle, like in some, you know, kind of maybe old school play or in some play.
Yep.
And I think there's some tables where that can turn really toxic. I think there's some tables where the players clearly are not on the same page as the DM as to what their what the session's going to be like. And so to me, forming a table, like we can all, I think, wordlessly imagine what makes our specific friends group table fun. And I can't remember a single thing that's been brought to it that hasn't been fun, because we all kind of have formed over time these expectations of like what the play is like.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think that's the case for every table.
Like what great play is.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah. I definitely had an experience where I left high school where I had these three friends that I played with for 8 years or something. And I went to college and I convinced my college dorm mates to play. They had been players and we played Dark Sun, and I started to do my thing where I ratcheted up the tension, and I had not built the trust of being their friends for years.
Mm-hmm.
And they thought that I was just the killer DM.
Right.
And they just started to react the way they should if they thought that, which was like they started to fight against me.
Yeah.
Right.
Mm. And they're a rules lawyer, you.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly. And yeah. it was a really eye-opening, startling experience.
Yeah. 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 I can definitely see that.
I just want to mention the first time I ever realized that there was a impedance mismatch between player and GM expectations was I remember I was up, you know, my friend Sammy and I were up like hanging out in his bedroom. We were playing, I don't know, Castle Amber or something like that.
Uh-huh.
And one of the classic modules. And I remember we'd played it like three times at that point. And I was DMing, and I remember he turned to me. He's like, you know, I'm kind of bored of this module. And I just like, it hit me like a ton of bricks.
Yeah.
I was like, what do you mean? You know, you're bored of this module, you know, like this is so fun. Like there's still other rooms to explore. Like,
yeah.
But we'd done the same story. But for me, it was still fun because I was like, you know, trying to lead him through other areas or whatever. But no, you know, I mean, it isn't fun for the players.
It isn't. Yeah. This is why I've struggled with convention play. Yeah. It's something I've only attempted a few times, but you know, the tables are so alien because you don't know the people and everyone hasn't really set expectations of how things go. And I'm sure there's people who are maybe listening who are saying that there's great examples of convention play and they have a ton of fun with conventions. I personally struggle with it.
I have done it many times, actually, and I would say several times.
Mm-hmm.
And I've had fun moments during the convention play, and it always gives me big anxiety.
Yeah.
And I don't know that, like, if I had to make a choice, I wouldn't, you know, I push myself to do it.
Yeah, totally.
Because it's like it's a thing other people do that I think I should be able to do.
Right. Or you can go experience games that you don't have a chance to play. Or,
that's right.
Yeah.
That's
I mean, I've run convention games. Right. Right. Mm-hmm. So
I think another example of mismatch play that I was in that you ran, Ethan, was we were playing Trail of Cthulhu. And, you know, we went to this place that was far away, and at least one of the players got really creeped out, and the game turned from uncover the mystery and get to the bottom of it and became, I'm going to run from this problem.
Right.
And it was like, you know, it was really startling. I think it turned out fine, but it was definitely that player, even just mid game, pivoted and had a real mismatch with the rest of the table.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Tricky. This is a whole nother episode, but it's tricky. How do you manage that scenario? So, big question.
Totally.
That's expert level game mastering. All right. Well, do we feel like we explored this subject enough? I mean, it's a small topic.
Right.
Fun at the table.
Yeah.
You know, I'm sure we're going to revisit fun because it's kind of the lens on all the other future topics, which is one of the reasons why we chose it as this first one.
Yeah.
So I'm sure we'll return to fun.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Can I just, let me just maybe wrap up by asking, and I'll do it myself. Just like out of all of the stuff we talked about, what was something memorable for you guys that you're like, oh, this was really interesting for me and maybe is also interesting for other people?
I'll start. When we started talking a little bit about the difference between simulation, game mastery, and skills kind of mastery, I think that's something that I need to kind of think about more and how to bring back to my table. I'm someone who struggles to remember the rules sometimes. I think that does a disservice to people that want to experience the pleasure of I'm really understanding how this system works, or I've achieved a success because I've, you know, developed a mastery of the system or the skills that are needed within it. So that part really took away something for me that I think I'll take back to my table.
For me, that's the discussion we had about exploration and curiosity and awe. And I think trying to bring that sense of curiosity and awe back to the table is the thing that I'll take away from this and focus on.
Yeah, I like that we revisited the player types and also the sort of the simplified player model. I don't like to pigeonhole people ever, but it really helps to give me a handle on how to set expectations and how to like to look at how expectations, even when stated similarly from different players, might have really different outcomes later an hour into gameplay.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
How to cope with that, again, different topic, which hopefully we'll come back to in a future episode.
That'd be great.
All right.
That was a teaser, people. Okay. Well, listen, hey, thank you, everybody, for joining us.
Yeah, thank you.
You can reach out to us at rpgxray.com, where you will find links to ways to get in touch with us via email, social, or via the web. And we'll be doing these on a regular basis. Please make sure to subscribe. If you like the show, please give us a positive review, we hope, on your podcast client of choice. That really helps us in terms of discovery and helps other people find the show. So thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And we will talk to you next time on RPG X-Ray.
RPG X-Ray system going offline. Acquire frequencies for next transmission at rpgxray.com.